Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome Brian Selznick.
Hello, little people. It's so nice to be back among you. Thank you, David, and to everyone here at the museum. I'm so thrilled to be back talking about my book briefly, and then I'll talk a little bit about the making of the movie. And I'm thrilled that John Logan is here to talk about the adaptation and writing this for the screen. We did a press conference the other day, and one of the people from the press raised their hands and were like, we never see the writer and the screenwriter in the same room. And so it's really nice that John and I are mutual fans of each other. We both feel about the other one the way the other one feels. That could be bad, couldn't it? We both love each other. And so, so I'd like to talk a little bit first just about how I made the book. But before I begin, I thought I would start with just a brief reading from the start of my book, The Invention of Hugo Cabret. If you haven't seen it, it's a 530-page book with 300 pages of pictures. And so I tried to tell part of the story like a storyboard, like a silent movie. So if we could hit our cue... It'll come. This is dramatic. How are we doing back there? Close enough. And then the story continues from there, going back and forth, and we can cut the cue. And we go back and forth from the words to the pictures, of course. And so when I was making the book, I had really started when I had seen A Trip to the Moon from 1902 and loved this image of the rocket going into the eye of the man in the moon, and always wanted to write a story about a kid who gets to meet Georges Méliès, the director who made this movie. And so I started doing a little bit more research, and I found out that Méliès, in real life, had a collection of automatons that were destroyed and thrown away at the end of his life. And I imagined a boy climbing through the garbage and finding one of these broken machines, and that's really how this book began. And so I started researching automatons, discovered this automaton in the basement of the Franklin Institute. It was broken, but I was able to go and see how it worked, see how all of the machinery engaged, and I used this information to try to make the automaton in my book as realistic as possible. I went to Paris three times. It's one of the great hardships of being a writer and illustrator of children's books, is you often have to go to Paris three times to work on your projects. And so we went to the train stations of Paris. The train station where Méliès actually worked has been torn down. It's the only train station in Paris from that time period that was torn down. So I took some archival, I found some archival photographs, and then went to all of the other train stations from the time period, including the Musée d'Orsay, which was once a train station, and used that as reference. So this is the Gare du Nord, which became a central sort of a bank of images for my book, and then used these photographs and these details when I was doing the pictures. All the drawings in my book are done 3 inches by 5 inches. So I work very small, and then I draw them, I enlarge them when they go into the book. I also watched a lot of old movies while I was making the book. I didn't really know very much about French cinema other than A Trip to the Moon. My boyfriend's favorite movie is, or one of his favorite movies, is Jean Vigo's La Talante. And so I watched that, and that led me to René Clair, who made this movie called Under the Roofs of Paris. This eventually led me to François Truffaut, and all of these filmmakers had an influence on the making of the invention of Hugo Cabret. So I would, for instance, take a scene like this from Under the Roofs of Paris and transform it into a moment like this, where Hugo is following the old man home. So in the book, we have actual film stills at certain points, but we also have my translations of those film stills into other parts of the story. This is a scene where Hugo gets caught by the bad guy, the station inspector, and put in jail. And this is a reference to François Truffaut's The 400 Blows. And I'm going to hand the stage back over to David, but I just wanted to say thank you. It's a thrill to be here, and I can't wait for you to see the movie. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, you met Brian Selznick, and I'm very pleased that also tonight we have John Logan with us, who is a great screenwriter. His credits include Gladiator, The Aviator, for Martin Scorsese, and he adapted, not only had the audacity to adapt Brian Selznick, but he adapted Shakespeare, and there's a great film version of Coriolanus, directed by Ralph Fiennes, that's coming out later this year. So this is a big year for him, so please welcome John Logan.
Thank you.
And Brian Selznick again. You can applaud again for Brian Selznick. You have the best shoes tonight. Well, first, tell me a little bit more. You talked about what it meant to get this phone call from Scorsese, but did you, and you said that you really thought of this as a book, a pure book. But what are you thinking about this as a movie? Did that cross your mind?
No, people did ask me while I was making the book if I thought it could be a movie, because it's about the history of cinema, and it seems really obvious that it could be a movie. But I argued with people the whole 2.5 years I was making the book that it just couldn't be. And I remember saying to someone, a friend of mine, like, who would be interested? Like, why would someone want to make a movie about this story? Like, it just didn't... I know, it sounds totally stupid now because we're about to see a movie directed by Martin Scorsese based on this book. But at the time, it really was the farthest thing from anything I could have imagined.
And John, when did you first see the book, and then how did you get involved in this project?
Well, it's after Martin and I did The Aviator, and we had a really magnificent time working on it. We were trying to find something else to do, and so he called me one day and said, I have a book. I said, you know, Marty, I really don't want to do an adaptation. It's like I'm really doing original work. I've only done one adaptation, and that was Stephen Sondheim, it was Sweeney Todd, and it's, you know. And, you know, the things about adaptations is you spend years with the source material. So it has to be something that speaks to you very deeply. And he said, well, just read the book. I'm like, all right. So he sent the book, and this envelope comes, and it's like 6 inches thick. And I'm thinking, what the heck have I agreed to read? And I took it out, and I saw the cover, and I started reading Brian's book. And it was so beautiful and so powerful. And I think it is a masterpiece. I truly mean that. And I called Marty that day and said, when do we start?
And what were your thoughts about what you were going to have to do to this? I mean, because there's not, you know, this is a as you were going to see, about a 2-hour feature film. There's going to be as much as you love the book, there's going to be changes.
Yeah,
that
you have to make. Because the you know, Brian and I have talked a lot, and we've become really really close pals. I'm glad to say the demands of cinema are very different than the demands of literature, and the organizing principles about how you tell a story are exceedingly different. My sort of raison d'etre from the very beginning was preserve what is elementally true about that book. And to me, that was two things. It was part story and part tone. And the story that spoke to me in Brian's book was the story he wrote, which to me is about a damaged boy making a home for himself, not falling into a happy ending, but through grit, adventuresome spirit, compassion, finding the place where he belongs. And so I also knew that no matter what we had to cut or how we had to shape it for a movie, that had to be the story we were telling. But even more importantly, I told Brian this, that when I worked on the script, and it was a long, hard job, I had 5 copies of his novel open to different illustrations. So at every point I had in front, because my computer's here and my desk's here, I could look over and look, and there's Hugo, and there's Isabel, and there's a station inspector, and there's Georges. And I would turn the pages. So I would always have the tone of what Brian was writing, because that is the other truly unique thing about that amazing book, is sort of the lyrical, gentle tone of it. I thought the only way to capture that is to try to sort of channel the illustrations.
And what were your discussions like? What is the collaboration like? First of all, you said it was sort of funny that you're on the same stage together, but did you talk to Brian? Do you guys work?
No, I purposely didn't. I purposely asked Marty not to speak to him, while I was writing the first draft, because I felt I needed to just make all the mistakes I was going to make in adapting it, and I was like, I'm going to cut a character that I know is eventually going to come back, and I'm going to add characters that don't belong. So the ugly first process of making the first draft and the first few drafts of the script, I didn't want to talk to Brian, just so I could have those mistakes, and then he read them and we met.
And then what was it like working with Marty Scorsese? The Aviator is also very much a movie about movies that captures his love for movies. It's a different period in film history, but you know, how did that come into play, and how did you work with Marty?
Well, Marty's the great, you know, as Brian will tell you, he's the great, you know, we call him on the set the maestro, because he's like a great conductor in that he knows how to get the best out of each section, whether he's talking to Bob Richardson about how you shoot the film, or whether he's talking to Sir Ben Kingsley about honing performance, or when he's talking to me about the demands of language, the oral life of the piece, or the narrative. He knows how to really work and collaborate. And because we'd done The Aviator for years, we had sort of a shorthand, a vocabulary. So our discussions about Hugo were actually very brief. We talked about the book, we talked about what we love, we talked about Dickens, and that was it. And then we would reconvene after I'd done a draft and continue sort of shape it toward production.
Were you watching other early movies to sort of get in the spirit or to do research?
I was, because like Brian, before Hugo sort of ran into my life, I didn't know that much about French cinema or even silent cinema. I was a big sort of Lon Chaney fan, so I had one sort of slanting, you know, and a W. Griffith fan. So I knew a little bit about silent movies, but I didn't know anything about this era and practically nothing about Méliès. But Marty is the great cineast, and he's a walking encyclopedia, and his tentacles go out very far and wide to film history. So all the way along, he was feeding me. He was like throwing snippets over the fence of like, here's a Hungarian movie from 1912. Here's some images from René Clair that are great. And after a while, you have to be like, Marty, really? It's enough. I'm writing all day. I can't be watching these movies all night. But that's part of the fabric of the movie, and part of the reason he wanted to do it, I think.
And how much does the sort of reality of production and budgets come into play. When it's a movie like this, it's a big budget, it's a big production. You know, you have the freedom to just think up whatever you want, draw it on your little 3x5 card. But you have, for a screenwriter, it's different because you're dealing with a lot of money and a lot of people.
Right. I mean, you get the point. You get to the point where when you go into production, that finances matter and those decisions have to be made. The early work on the script before you're greenlit, before you go into production, is absolutely free work. It's like, you know, as much as Brian would sit down and say, you know, I want to write a scene where they go to the movies. You know, I could say I want to write a scene where they walk over the Seine. You know, and you just write it. You don't think about, well, when they have to shoot the Seine, we have to film it, we have to do CG. This shot's going to are showing Paris, which means a certain thing, and all the process of working, the actually making the movie is making those decisions, and it's just something disciplined filmmakers instinctively do.
And I'd like to ask both of you what you like, how you think about audience, because I think what's really true about this book and the film is that you might think at first, oh, this is for kids or this is for children because it's a boy. It's the main character, but you realize very quickly that it really is for all ages, and I wonder how you think about that in your creative process.
I mean, I definitely am aware that I'm writing for kids. Like, I love my audience. I think they're the best audience, and I generally think that my readership will be around the age of the character in the story. So Hugo was around 12, so I imagined the readership would be around there. But I'm not thinking about kids when I'm writing the book. I'm thinking about what will make the story work. And I tend to work very mechanically, piecing the plot together, you know, little bits at a time, and putting things from the beginning that affect the end and vice versa. And I never test my stories in progress with actual children. I never ask kids what they think. And so it makes it really terrifying when I'm working and when a book finally comes out. But the first day I was on tour with Hugo, I went to speak to a school, and I saw the kids like clutching the book to their chest like a treasured object, and I thought, that's got to be a good sign. But I'm just trying to make a good story. Like, that's really what it comes down to.
No, it's through osmosis, because I worked so closely, even though I'd never met him, with Brian, and you know, he was, you know, Brian's work was always, he was sort of like perched on my shoulder, and now that we're friends, he's literally perched on my shoulder a lot of the time. You know, that affected my work, but I never ever thought of this as a family movie or a kid's movie at all. I thought of it like the 400 Blows. I treated it as the same way I would treat The Aviator or Gladiator. It was just a great story in a particular context, and the context that Brian created was for the whole family.
Yeah. One thing that was really striking, and I'm not going to really give anything away about the film, but when you see the film, you realize how personal it is to Martin Scorsese, because movies were so important to him as a boy, and of course he's a filmmaker now, so he's sort of, you know, in a way he's partly, Méliès is partly him, and the boy is him. So I don't know, just wonder how that struck you, because it really, when you watch this film, you think this is a movie that Marty Scorsese was born to make, in a way.
Yeah, you know, if we could go back in time and tell myself what was going to happen while I was making the book, it, you know, obviously it would not make any sense to me. And I made this for myself. You know, it actually came at a point in my career where I felt very low, and I was very frustrated, and some bad things had happened, and I just was frustrated, and this came out of the fact that I didn't have anything else to do, and someone said to me, make the book you want to make, and this is what came out of that statement. And so, you know, cut to today, and I've seen the movie a few times now. Last night was the big red carpet premiere, and I saw the theater, you know, saw it on the screen of the Ziegfeld, surrounded by 1,600 people, and it feels like I wrote, I mean, I'm aware that it feels like I wrote this book for Martin Scorsese. Like, I feel like I made it for him. But I never could have tried to do that. It just is what happened. One of the reviews said that it felt like Martin Scorsese's imaginary autobiography. And I thought that was beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, completely. I mean, one of the things when Marty and I were talking about the book, you know, one of the elements from Brian's novel that we seized on very strongly was the idea that movies are magic. Once upon a time, movies were magic. And what binds thematically or dramaturgically, one of the things that binds Hugo to Georges Méliès is they believe this technology is magic. And whether you're performing a card trick, making a movie, even watching a movie, there has to be something enchanted about it. So we knew we couldn't be cynical about movie making. We knew we had to look at it as if it was always, I remember him using the image, it's always Dorothy opening the door, stepping into Technicolor. Every second of this movie has to have that feeling of magic.
Well, it certainly does. Two last questions, and then we'll take a few questions from the audience, and then we'll finally get to see Hugo. But I just want to hear a little bit, from both of you, about what it's like on a movie set. Sort of what surprised you about the... Because there's no more, like, amazingly collaborative process. And again, you do your books basically alone, but films are made with hundreds of people. So, like, what was the main sort of thing that surprised you about being on a movie set?
Well, I think stepping onto a Martin Scorsese movie set is perhaps not the average experience of walking onto a movie set, although it was my first one. So everyone was like, oh, it's all going to be disappointing after this. You know, it's the most unbelievable thing. I said it's like hanging out with God, because they can make it like any time of day, any weather, any time period. It can go anywhere in the world. It all is made, and it happens. I was there on the set the night they filmed the scene where Georges Méliès burns his sets and costumes, and the moon wasn't, and it's actually filmed outside, and the moon wasn't quite bright enough in real life. So they took out this giant scaffolding, got this big piece of blue fabric, a crane came, lifted up this thing, and suddenly this giant hanging box of fabric lit up from behind, and it cast this perfect blue moonlight over the entire scene. And it was purely magical. And walking through these sets that Dante Ferretti built, full size, you know, the full size train station, the full size Méliès apartment, which you'll see, it's all, like I was saying about the kitchen, it's all there. And it's an unbelievable and beautiful and thrilling experience, especially because it was based on my little drawing. So I had the ability to look around and be like, Dante, that looks like the metal grate that I drew in the book. And Dante said, that is the metal grate you drew in your book. I make it exactly.
One thing Brian said is completely true. Is there some Martin Scorsese set is very different, and every film set has its own energy. You know, a Tim Burton set feels a certain way. A Ridley Scott set feels a certain way. But there's something about a Marty set. It's like you're working with old world masters, and everyone around him is absolutely the best in their field. So it's as if you're at the studio, and there's Rembrandt, then there's Caravaggio, and there's Titian, and there's Goya, and he just brings the best people working, and there's sort of a very hushed efficiency about it, a gentle hush that's very unique to his set, I think.
This is a 3D movie. I think it's a real breakthrough in the use of 3D. I'm just wondering how that fed into the process, or how what you thought about that. I don't know if it affected how you wrote the film.
No, it certainly did. Once we made the decision to move to 3D, it gave me opportunities, encouraged me to find ways to move through space. So I became a lot more active in the descriptions. And you would have noticed this, because after you started reading all the drafts, I became more active about things like moving through the hallways, going through the automaton, moving through places. And it's also when there are three dogs who are Brian's favorite characters in the...
Dogs in my book, you may remember.
There are three dogs you're going to love in the movie, and they became two dachshunds and a Doberman, which are long 3D dogs.
And also, the way Bob Richardson, the cinematographer, was thinking about 3D and light and atmosphere, they had these ideas. Like, I went onto the set and I saw on the 3D monitor as it was being filmed that, you know how sometimes when sunlight's coming in a window, it catches dust and it looks all sparkly? I noticed that they happened to catch some of the dust in the air. And I said to someone, oh my God, look what luck that it happened to catch the dust. And they're like, are you kidding? It was Bob Richardson's idea. We went around the world to find the best goose down feathers, graded them up, and before every shot, there's someone over there blowing them into the scene. And then there's constantly smoke and steam and all sorts of atmospherics that are coming out in different levels, so that you're always aware of what the 3D is doing and that you're in space. And what the dust did, which I especially loved, was it helps bring you into the world of the train station in a very, very subtle and beautiful way.
Yeah. Okay. And so let's take a few questions, and then we'll start the film. But raise your hand, and I can repeat a question if anybody has one. Over there.
David, what was your art training, and why did you choose to use 3x5 cards to draw?
Oh, yeah. What was your art training, and why, how come you work on 3x5 cards instead of something bigger?
Yeah, I did the drawing small because, not to give too much away, but at the end of the book, if you haven't read it, it has something to do with an automaton, and I had seen a real automaton draw about this size. So I wanted to do my drawings as if I was the automaton. And plus, it takes less time because there's less paper to cover. And I tend to work pretty tightly, and when you work small and blow it up, it loosens everything up and allows the light to come through in a way. And I went to the Rhode Island School of Design, but I did not want to illustrate children's books when I was in school because that's what everyone used to tell me I should do. So it made me really fight against it until I graduated from college and realized that that's what I should be doing. I failed at not being a children's book illustrator.
Okay.
I think they want to see the movie.
I think so. So let's see the movie. What we're, before we stop, I just want to say it's going to take us just a few minutes to set up because we're going from basically a PowerPoint presentation to digital 3D. So there's be a minute or two of stuff happening on the screen. So ignore that, and then you'll enjoy the magic of movies. And I do want to say that this one great thing about this movie is that it inspires people to be interested in film history, film archiving, film preservation. So, you know, you'll have, like, all of a sudden people will be running out to apply to film archiving programs. But it really does inspire people to get interested in film history. So for us at the museum, that's an exciting thing. Great. So... okay, but congratulations to both of you as you're about to see. So enjoy the movie.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.